we've rarely ventured into the territory of any historic relationship between India and Australia. Well, tonight we will, by looking at what happened when Australian Conservative politician Richard Casey was appointed as governor of Bengal in 1944. Last week, Karma McLean, who's associate professor of South Asian history at the University of New South Wales, gave a talk at the National Library called Richard Casey and the Bengal Famine. It was in the midst of famine, a man-made famine, that killed more than 3 million people. And this stint in Casey's career has largely been forgotten, or perhaps it's a case of repressed memory. Karma thinks that it reveals very important lessons about colonial politics and the historical relationship between our two countries. And she joins me in the studio. Welcome to our little program.
Thank you so much, Philip.
Your story is about Richard and his time as governor of Bengal, but remind the listeners of his career before that appointment.
He had an extraordinary career before that. He, of course, is in Gallipoli. He serves in France as well. He comes back and he's in the Treasury in Australia. He is then appointed to be one of the... He is the first Australian in Washington, D.C., setting up the legation there. From there goes to the War Cabinet and is in charge of supplying the Middle East. And it's from there that he's actually appointed to Bengal in 1944.
We should also point out that he had a very distinguished military career, didn't he?
He
won a couple of major gongs.
He did indeed. And set up some very interesting connections, which I think served him quite well later on in his career.
I mentioned at the head of the program that Menzies, later Sir Robert, was always a bit chary about Richard because he saw him as challenging his preeminence at the top of the pile.
The two did not get along well at all. It's interesting, Walter Crocker, who was also around in India at this time, talks about how Casey had class and Menzies never forgave him for it. So.
Well, he's just a poor lad from Japara, for heaven's sake.
Yes, Geelong.
Now, Karma, you point out in your research that his appointment as governor of Bengal was unexpected and to many unacceptable.
Very unexpected. There had been no Australians appointed to such a high level in British India into the administration. And in particular in 1944 it comes as a surprise because India is starting to decolonise, really. I mean, the show of British India was well and truly up. Of course, it's in the middle of the war and the British themselves aren't about to concede that. And so Casey's appointment is unusual because Indians are actually expecting that they will, instead of actually having Dominion statesmen appointed as governors, then perhaps more Indians will be appointed. But more importantly, they're very upset about the White Australia policy. And
of course, because it's in absolutely the peak of its powers and influence.
And it had been very well known in India since 1901, quite literally.
So the Indian press complained that an Australian getting the job, but back in Australia, it's the Australian Communist Party who started a media campaign.
They did. And indeed, that's your Slippery Dick quote comes from a poem that is put along with a cartoon from The Guardian in Melbourne. There was a young man from Geelong.
Guardian. With proper respect, the Communist Guardian was the first newspaper I ever wrote for. Now proceed.
There was a young man from Geelong, White Australia, he accepted for so long. The Bengalese thought it thick that this slippery dick should rule where he didn't belong.
Well, that's potent, isn't it? So before we talk about the famine in Bengal and how it came about, Bengal was much more strategically significant than I realised.
Oh, it was the centre of war operations after the entrance of Japan and after the fall of Burma. In fact, one of the primary briefs that he's given in Bengal is to operate the province in such a way that another Dickie Mountbatten, can organise operations effectively. And part of the brief is to make sure that Gandhi doesn't get up to any nonsense. while he's there. And, of course, Gandhi's in prison for most of the time, so he doesn't.
So during World War II, it was occupied with the Japanese, and heavens above, a lot of boots on the ground.
Wasn't occupied, but it was on the front line of war.
With Burma just
Yes, absolutely. And the big concern was because Calcutta was India's biggest industrial city, and to have it so close to Burma and the Japanese front was a terrible risk.
And Calcutta was bombed by the Japanese
in 1943 in December. Not a lot of lives lost, but creates a lot of fear in the province that never really goes away.
Let's now talk about the dynamics of the famine. How did it begin?
So the famine, there is a lot of causes behind the famine, but it is ultimately a man-made tragedy. There's always this presumption in India, and there's a long history of famines in colonial India, and this presumption that somehow it's a product of culture and not of political economy. And of course, this is a particularly unsustainable premise when you start looking at the Bengal famine of 1943, which is heavily as a result of a wartime economy. So there was already food shortages as a result of very steep price rises in 1941, followed by the occupation of Burma. There is the loss of rice supplies from Burma. Then on top of that, there's a poor harvest and a cyclone, which undermines crops in that particular in the year. But then we have a policy of denial, which is a government decision by the government of India to deny any oncoming Japanese army of rice or fish. And the way they do that is they quite literally go up and they collect rice stocks. They make an assessment of how much Bengalis need. They get the numbers wrong. They put it into grain houses. They literally take it off the market. This raises the price of rice, and those who can't afford rice, the very poor and especially the rural poor, simply start to starve.
You've unearthed some really great stuff from archives. Quote, Bengal was well known among Britons for its radical anti-colonial policies as much as for its sultry climate. And Casey noted that two of his predecessors had died in office and that others had been, quote, shot at on quite a number of occasions, to the extent that an actor performing in a Christmas panto in Calcutta had joked that to become the governor of Bengal was the greatest curse of all.
Mm. So there was a long history of anti-colonialism in Bengal, and it was often quite violent. The British write about terrorism in Bengal as being a major political phenomenon. Casey's immediate predecessor actually dies pretty much in office, there's a talk of the actual, the governorship being cursed because two governors, in fact, die in office
What are the religious demographics at the time?
You know, it's very hard to pick. There's no census that's terribly recent because the census is done every 10 years. The last one was 1931. They didn't conduct it in 41. And demographics shift quite substantially as a result of the famine. A lot of people come into Calcutta for food. So it's really hard to pick what the precise demographics are, but roughly half-half Hindu-Muslim.
Now, Casey becomes aware, to some extent at least, of British involvement in prolonging the famine.
You know, he does. He seems to always fall short of actually acknowledging the extent of the man-made element of the famine. He is much more concerned and focused on trying to rehabilitate. And in particular, one of his big focuses is on convincing the public to have faith in the government and supply. So one of the problems of the famine is that there's a lot of hoarding as a result of the panic when the denial policy is put into place. And Casey believes that if people can be made to have faith in government, then they will cease to hoard and market conditions will return to normal.
Tell me about some decisions made by Churchill who failed to send grain to India.
Yes, this is true. So shipping was tightly controlled during the Second World War by the War Cabinet. There was actually a lot of wheat in Australia that Australia was willing to send to India, but Churchill in particular and the shipping committee would not provide the shipping to go from Australia to Bengal. They said it couldn't be spared, but it was basically a matter of where Churchill's priorities lay, and they did not lie in India.
I have a faint memory from decades past of bags of wheat on the walls, which weren't inexplicable culturally to the Indians who were used to soft grain.
You know, so the issue with Australian wheat going over to Bengal was, I mean, the predominant grain consumed in Bengal was rice. We didn't have rice, but we did have a surplus of wheat. We actually had enormous amounts. And there were civil society organisations clamouring, in fact, and lobbying the Australian government to send wheat over. Wheat would have made a difference. It would have actually saturated the market and simply changed the sort of dynamics around scarcity that was driving prices up so high.
When Casey arrives, how does he go about trying to improve the situation with food supplies?
He does a number of things. I mean, ultimately, he's not in charge of the sort of macro picture, which is, you know, sending grain from elsewhere and managing imports better. But he does a number of things. He passes a destitute's rehabilitation bill. He does an enormous amount of public propagandizing, I guess you could say, to try and convince people to stop thinking that the famine still exists. In fact, the famine, I mean, we talk about it as being a famine of 1943, but actually people continue to die for many years after. There's epidemics that follow the famine, cholera, malaria and smallpox. And these are all issues that he actually has to contend with.
While Casey's trying to do something to help, you have a very weird portrayal of him in an English magazine. And this is the Casey family, Dick with May Casey, who in parenthesis I should point out was Joan Lindsay's best friend, living it up in a Calcutta palace. Not a good look.
Yeah, this is why I think it's an interesting moment for Australia-India relations, and not least because Casey, of course, becomes the external affairs minister under Menzies for so long and therefore is in a position actually to shape Australia-India relations. But we have these very different experiences of colonialism. So whereas Casey is projected in the Australian press as being at the heart of the empire, in this sort of classic Raj mythologies, we also have the Bengal famine happening, you know, in the same province. And the two different pictures are very hard to actually reconcile.
Impossible. One of the highlights of his time in Bengal, and you've already hinted at it, were meetings with Gandhi. Tell me about these.
His meetings with Gandhi are really interesting, and I've written about them elsewhere. Gandhi approaches him. Gandhi's actually let out of prison. So Gandhi's arrested in 1942 after the Quit India movement is called. And he's in prison until 1944 when he's released because he's unwell. And the British are worried that he'll die in prison, and that would also be a bad look. He recovers for a while, and then in 1945, after the war is over, he approaches Casey to come and visit Bengal to try and do something about the famine. And eventually Casey agrees, and he meets Gandhi in a series of meetings in December of 1945, by which time Casey's already resigned. He's really packing his bags and on his way home, and seems to be willing to actually make a difference, even at the expense of upsetting the Viceroy. And so he tries to open up negotiations with the Viceroy and Gandhi again.
So Dick Casey's in conflict with Dick Mountbatten.
Not Mountbatten, with Wavell.
Oh,
Lord
I see.
Wavell, yeah.
Right.
So Gandhi's relationship with Wavell's broken down quite badly by this stage, and Wavell refuses to meet Gandhi, and so Gandhi seems to try and find almost a back route, if you like, through Casey. And Casey actually asks Gandhi's mind is, why is Gandhi coming to me? And the answer is, because you're an Australian. You're this, you know, intermediary.
He was a back channel, for heaven's sake.
Effectively, yes.
How extraordinary.
Yes, and it's an interesting set of negotiations which are covered in the press. There's a lot of press speculation about what they're talking about. And sometimes they talk about, you know, very banal things. Sometimes they talk about, you know, serious political issues such as, you know, what will happen? Is Pakistan going to be created? You know, what should the British do at one stage, Casey asks.
Did Casey keep journals?
He did. He kept a diary on a daily basis. It's fairly guarded, but his thoughts are written down and set out in a fairly procedural sort of manner. I think his correspondence is much more revealing than his diaries.
In what sense?
Well, he writes to Wavell, for example, and projects what he's, you know, his reading of his discussions with Gandhi. And at some time, you know, at times he he's under enormous pressure, of course, and he's not got the funding that he needs to try and alleviate the famine. And he writes to Wavell in often quite terse terms, in a way that's, you know, in some ways quite surprising. So I think his correspondence is probably, personal correspondence is more revealing than some of his diary entries.
So you think that Casey's experiences in Bengal made him realise that the imperial game was pretty much over?
I think so. I think he becomes a much bigger critic of imperialism after seeing it up close. He, you know, one of the things he says over and over again after he comes back from India is that personal relations in British India have been extremely bad. The British have not attempted to understand Indians, to meet with them, to speak with them on equal terms. And he talks over and over about this idea of human relations in British India as being extremely bad.
So while Casey is often regarded as, like Menzies, as British to the bootstraps and a wholehearted classic supporter of the empire, he was beginning to question its assumptions.
I believe so. I mean, and ultimately he did hold the line when pushed. He ultimately did do what he was there to do, but he was a much more careful and, I think, reasoned critic of British imperialism than his biographers have given him credit for.
Given May's great friendship with Joan Lindsay, I'm wondering whether May kept records or a diary.
May, in the years that I'm doing, May doesn't have a diary, but she does write to, she writes to a large number of people and often talks about the things that they're doing in British India. They also have a very good press secretary / personal assistant to both, Pat Jarrett. She's an Australian journalist. And I think she's also extremely close to May, and I think she's responsible for a lot of a very positive projection in the media.
Is there a memory of the Bengal famine in India?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Stories, visuals, photography remains. I don't think it's been forgotten at all. Absolutely, it's still very alive. And of course, the sort of recent interventions by someone like Shashi Tharoor have revived the memory in very clear terms.
And the death toll finally in the famine?
Ultimately, the count is not precise, but the number that's often bandied around is upward of 3 million. And I think that's probably in 1943 alone. People continue to die, not as a result of necessarily hunger, but as a result of weakened constitutions and epidemics in the years after.
Do you think the British have chosen to forget it? I mean, I hinted at the possibility of not just absent-mindedness, but perhaps a repressed memory of a terrible time.
It's interesting. The famine is often seen as a tragedy for the empire and a risk for the war effort rather than a humanitarian tragedy. In the records that I've seen, there's a long-term denial of the actual the extent of the situation in Bengal at the time. And that, of course, means that adequate relief can't be sent, because if you can't accept, if there's a basic denial of the impact, then, of course, where is the question of relief?
But your account is denial, 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 isn't it?
Different kinds of denial. The denial policy to deny the rice from Japan, but then denial of there being a famine.
And it was considered, very naughty to deny the denials.
Indeed.
Look, thanks for that. Karma McLean is Associate Professor of South Asian and World History at the University of New South Wales, and she joined me in the studio, which is nice to have a live guest from time to time.